That's why to get your consent here to wait just for another three minutes until other members join us. And with our meeting, irrespective of the quorum, there are members who have not apologized, but they're still not joining us. We only have four apologies from Mr. Mabasa, Mr. Ntuli, the verbal one now from Mr. Manamela, Dr. Wang, who's abroad, Mr. Khailem, who's attending another committee, and Mr. Holomisa. This is a standing apology from Mr. Holomisa, I guess. Those are the apologies that we have. I don't know if we can approve them. If we agree on these apologies, then we can continue. Members? Dr. Ravi? Thank you. Let's continue with our agenda. Today we have requested the Competition Commission to brief us on the Competition Act. This follows our previous meetings wherein we requested them to just update us, because they did inform us on the amendments made to that principal act, even though they are not yet proclaimed. But today we'll hear from them what are the reasons for that. We needed them just to acquaint us on the issues related to the amendment, and they will do so. I don't know whether is it who is going to give us this presentation, but I guess it's Mr. Ramburu. Thank you. May we then hand over to you for our briefing. I won't do introductions because we have done introductions previously. We'll just go straight to your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. I should maybe just briefly introduce the team. Thembi Nkosi Bonakele is to my left, and he's the Deputy Commissioner. Norman Manome is the Chairperson of the Competition Tribunal, and Yasmin Karim is a full-time member of the Competition Tribunal. Chairperson, I've prepared a presentation, but after our discussion this morning, I should just preface it a little bit, because most of what I wanted to talk about was the Amendment Act, but it might be useful just to kind of talk about what is contained in the Principal Act before we proceed on that. The competition, the architecture of the Principal Act basically is about, okay, remember what this act is intending to do is to deal with anti-competitive behavior in the economy, a big sign of which is high market concentration. So if one or two firms own the whole market, that's a problem. So what the act, how the act is designed is there's essentially two big things that the act does. It deals with merger control, and then it deals with prohibited restrictive practices. Now the merger control side of the act is, you can imagine, is to prevent future concentration in the economy. When firms are merging, there's only two firms in a market and they're merging and you end up with one, you end up with a monopoly, and in that kind of extreme situation, we are required to prohibit that transaction because going forward, markets will become more and more concentrated. So the idea behind merger control is that you want to prevent higher levels of concentration going forward. With prohibited restrictive practices, this is a more backward-looking thing. This is about behavior that firms have participated in that result in the lessening of competition in the market. And essentially, under the prohibited practices section, there's two broad kinds of prohibited practices. One category is about firms getting together and colluding with each other. So firms that ought to be competing with each other now will come together and form a cartel, and instead of competing with each other, they coordinate their conduct, and that results in, that has anti-competitive consequences. So we call that, what I've spoken about, horizontal restrictive practices. This is a firm getting together with all its competitors to fix markets in one way or the other. The other category under prohibited practices is abuse of dominance. This is when there is one big dominant firm in the market and it's abusing the position it holds in that market by either charging an excessive price or by excluding other players from the market. It wields its power in that marketplace, in that particular market, in a manner that restricts competition in one way or the other. And essentially, that's broadly the kinds of work we do. We do merger control, and we take up cases of anti-competitive conduct. Those cases are either collusion cases in most instances, or they're abuse of dominance cases. The rest of the Act sets out the institutions that will you know, kind of describes, sets up institutions to implement this Act. It's clear about the procedures we might follow in the different areas we're dealing with, and sets the rules by which this Act gets implemented under general. So chapters 2 and 3 of the Act are essentially the main chapters of the Act. That if you want to kind of look at, if you want to go back to the Act and look at what the meaty part of the Act is, it's under those sections. Now, so the rest of my talk now will be about the most recent development in the evolution of this legislation, which is the Competition Amendment Act of 2009. And just some background to this is that a policy review of competition policy was initiated by the DTI in 2006. And this in some ways was what led up ultimately to the amendment. But in between all of that, some very important things were happening as well. And I think it is interesting to look at the context within which this amendment was put into place. Firstly, I think, everybody would be aware, it's around 2007, 2008, there was public outrage against a whole lot of anti-competitive practices that the Competition Commission was exposing. In particular, the bread cartel got many people very angry about the situation, and everybody felt we needed to be tough and be doing something more about this kind of situation that people found kind of morally very offensive. Government also responded quite kind of positively to the work we were doing. We got lots of commitments from very senior politicians, and the president in two of his speeches mentioned that government was committed to strengthening the competition authorities. And in that context, the Amendment Act was a process was set up to amend the Act to give us these additional powers and strengthen us. That Act was assented to in August 2009. It's not yet in force. It has been signed off by the President. All he has to do is set a date on which it becomes operational. I have in the slides put just a kind of outline of all the different things that happened from the very beginning till now, just the process of how you know, this act was considered in Parliament and all the processes it went through. I'm not going to go to that in detail. But I think what I should say here is that, as with all legislation, I would imagine, it's not an agency like ours that manages this process. This process is managed by the government department that's responsible for us. That government department was DTI, now recently changed to EDD, and because they are the custodians of policy. They are the policy makers. We are the implementers of policy, and we of course participate in the process on invitation, which we've done in this instance. So in the places you see here where there were, you know, there were submissions called for, or there were presentations to be made in Parliament, we participated in all of that. We've made lots of presentations around this. We've made, you know, lots of paper, lots of, as well as oral presentations to Parliament. But the process itself, we are just one of the many stakeholders, if you like, in the view of the DTI. And they kind of consulted more broadly than us in putting in this process as described here. I'm not going to go through this step by step, but what I will look at when I go to the detail of each of the amendments, what the kinds of debates were and what our submissions has been with respect to those key areas. Okay, so I'm just going to pick out the key amendments. These are all the amendments, essentially, and go through them one by one and just give a sense of what these amendments are about and what they're intending to achieve and how they're constructed and what they will mean for us as institutions. Okay, the first of the amendments is the Act introduces this concept of a complex monopoly. Okay, and this is, you know, this is an attempt to give the competition authorities an opportunity to investigate concentrated sectors where there isn't any specific anti-competitive conduct, but what is being looked at is the outcome. In other words, so the way it's constructed in the Act is, if a complex monopoly is defined, if you like, as a market in which 75% of the goods and services are supplied by less than five firms. If there's fewer than five firms in a market, and they produce. If less than five firms in a particular market produce 75% of the goods and services, and it's found that these firms kind of conduct their business and set their prices in a way that's pretty similar to each other, the outcome of the pricing and the outcome of their conduct generally is pretty similar, but there's no concrete agreement between them, then that market is defined as a complex monopoly. Okay. Now, you know, this in the course, I should just reflect here that in the course of the policy debates around this was a very concerning thing for businesses, because you can imagine that there's a number of markets in South Africa where you know, a large percentage of goods are produced by a very small number of firms. If you think of banking, for example, you know, that's the case. You've got like four firms producing more than 75% of goods and services in that market. And so the Act kind of defines this complex monopoly, which is a new concept for us. It's outside that architecture I kind of explained earlier. It's also kind of a fairly unique provision in competition law internationally. There's not many other countries that use this kind of provision. Some of them have it, like the UK, but you know, these are old provisions that they've not used for a long time. And so what the Act says after defining what a complex monopoly is, it says that when the Commission finds the situation, it could apply to the tribunal for a declaratory order against these firms if under certain conditions, right? If we find, for example, that in this market there's high entries to barrier, if certain firms might be excluded, there might be excessive pricing, or if one of these firms refuse to supply goods or services to other firms, then the Commission must apply for a declaratory order to the tribunal saying that this is that this situation is illegal, and that declaratory order just declares that particular behavior that we in our investigation uncovered is illegal. It doesn't punish firms for that in the first instance. You've got to be a repeat offender. You've got to, after a declaratory order, if you then continue that behavior, then you are susceptible to a fine. Okay? You can see from this that this isn't the kind of sharpest instrument we have. We can, you know, for some cases, we might well opt to use our straight down the line regular cartel enforcement provisions because they have stronger sanctions. In other words, the punishment there is bigger. Here, you just get a declaratory order. Only if you're a second time offender, you get fined for it. Okay, so that's around complex monopolies. There were a few things just to reflect on the debate on this. This, as I said, this was a thing that business was concerned about in the course of the policy discussions in Parliament, and as a consequence of a lot of those debates, the initial Act was adjusted and changed. So, for example, in the initial Act, there wasn't an opportunity for firms to have a defense, you know, to say that the last point in my slide, that firms can raise pro-competitive efficiency and technological defenses. Now the way the Act is articulated is, even if we have the finding, when it goes to the tribunal must hear from the firms if there's any good reason, any pro-competitive reasons or efficiency-enhancing reasons why that behavior ought to continue.
Well, is this provision in the amendment?
Yes. All the things I'm talking about are in the amendment now.
Which is not effective.
Well, it's kind of been signed and passed, but a date for its implementation has not been set. So that's complex monopolies. The next major issue that was dealt with in this amendment is the criminalization of cartel conduct. Okay, this is perhaps the kind of most dramatic thing that this amendment bill does, and it is something that, you know, has been also thoroughly debated in the portfolio committee. And here, the way this works is that it is an offense for a director of a firm or a person within management in the firm who knowingly cause or knowingly acquiesce to a firm's collusive conduct. So essentially, what it's saying is that, you know, if you're in a senior management, leadership, board, director position in a firm, and if you ought to have known about certain things by the very nature of your position. So a director can't say, look, I didn't know what's going on. They ought to know. Then you become liable for prosecution personally, criminal prosecution. Okay? and you're liable for a fine of up to R500,000 or 10 years in imprisonment. The Act makes it very clear that this fine must be paid by the individual, and the firm cannot pay on behalf of the individual. This is also something that was debated in the portfolio committee, and people felt that that needed to be put in. And but the important thing around this provision is that is and it's, at this point it's important to make this distinction. Up to now, the way the Competition Act is constructed and the way we go about running our cases and producing evidence is we do it on a civil legal standard. Okay, so a civil standard essentially means that you've got to prove something on the balance of probabilities. So if chances are that was a likely thing to happen, that's enough for the adjudicator to decide on your side, decide in your favor. But once you criminalize, then the legal standard changes, and one then has to make your case on a beyond reasonable doubt standard. Okay, so in other words, if we're prosecuting a firm right now, Norman's the adjudicator, and he will kind of balance the evidence and say, well, on the balance of probabilities, you are probably right. We're going to decide in your favor. But in a criminal prosecution, the adjudicator must only decide against somebody if it is beyond reasonable doubt. Okay, this is a very important distinction. This has been introduced into the terrain of administrative law, which is what institutions like the Commission and Tribunal are involved in, work with, and now we've got to kind of interact. We have an interface with the criminal side by the introduction of this provision. The important thing here as well is that it's not the competition authority that proceeds with criminal prosecution, right? This is something that an NPA must do. So the way the system will work is that we will take up a case against a firm. If the firm is found to be guilty of some or other conduct, then the NPA must then make a call on whether they then proceed to prosecute the individual involved. Now, this was, in the course of the debates leading up to this bill, was a matter of great concern for us as the agency, because at the time, and even now, we have had considerable success with our corporate leniency policy. And the corporate leniency policy essentially is where you allow a firm to come and tell you everything about any illegal behavior they were involved in, and if they tell you everything and if they cooperate with you to prosecute the remaining members of a cartel, then they will get leniency, which means that we won't prosecute them, we won't proceed with the case against them. And you can imagine that now if you criminalize this, what criminalization does to this is that, you know, why would if I was the CEO of a company or a senior manager, why would I go and tell the competition authorities about anti-competitive behavior, knowing that at some later stage, I might be the person who gets criminally prosecuted? Okay, so it would. Our concern was that it would disincentivize people from using the CLP, because they wouldn't come forward and tell us about the firm's bad behavior for fear that they, at a later stage, might be personally prosecuted and will have to face this R500,000 or 10-year fine. Okay, because the way the CLP essentially works is it requires the cooperation of somebody, of an insider, for us to have success. And we were very concerned that the criminalization would blunten that. It would kind of prevent people from coming forward for fear of prosecution. We made this, we argued this point and made it quite strongly in the course of the entire debates in Parliament, and a lot of adjustments were made as a consequence of that. One of which, and the most important one, was the way this will now work is that if we get an application for leniency from an individual on behalf of his firm, we may produce, we may give that person a certificate saying that that individual is deserving of leniency, and that person must take it to the NPA should the NPA decide to prosecute him, and the NPA must consider that before they proceed with their case or not. So we will say in our certificate, look, this person has really helped us, he's been very cooperative, he's given us all the information, his participation was important in our success in prosecuting this firm. Look, NPA, we'd like you to consider, we think this person deserves leniency, we'd like you not to proceed with a prosecution against that person. So we'll give the person the certificate, but even as it's constructed right now, that certificate is not a guarantee that that person will not be prosecuted, because the decision gets taken independently by the NPA. The NPA, of course, will consider this, but they might consider a whole range of other things, and notwithstanding the certificate, might decide to proceed with a prosecution against that individual. So, you know, although it's partly kind of covered our concerns, there's still the chance that it could blunten this important tool that we have, which is corporate leniency. So, you know, that's just kind of, there were other kind of changes that were made to this as a result of our inputs, but that is the most important one. Okay. I think the last point here is just to say that the NPA can only proceed with a prosecution against an individual if they have either if the firms concerned have either admitted to wrongdoing, admitted to unlawful behavior, or if there is a finding by the tribunal or the courts that there has been an unlawful behavior. So the criminalization thing, you see, works in two stages. In the first stage, a case needs to be made that anti-competitive behavior of the firm has occurred on the civil standard, and then the NPA kicks in and prosecutes the individual on the criminal standard. Okay? And the complexity here is about how the corporate leniency policy will be affected, and whether it will incentivize or disincentivize individuals from using it. Okay, those are now the two more controversial parts of the amendment that kind of resulted in more debate and lots of concerns raised. The rest of them are perhaps less controversial. The market inquiries provision essentially gives the commission use of its investigative powers to inquire into a market. You all recall that the commission conducted an inquiry into the banking sector, and we used very rudimentary provisions in the Act to do that. We were allowed to do that in terms of the Act, but we weren't given the powers in the course of that inquiry to, for example, subpoena information, subpoena documents, compel people to come and give evidence before the inquiry. So the banking inquiry was done on a completely voluntary basis. We kind of banked on the cooperation of players in that market. Now we've got provisions in the Act through this provision to give us the power to, for example, subpoena information and individuals to give us information. Essentially, it also allows for the minister to request us to do a market inquiry, and upon and there's a whole procedure set out on how we do this. We've got to publish in the Government Gazette. We've got a, you know, it's kind of quite a transparent process. And at the end of it all, we can do one of three things. We can submit a report to the minister with recommendations or without recommendations, saying, look, this is what we found in the market inquiry. We can initiate a formal complaint against firms based on the information we gathered in the course of the market inquiry, or we can refer a complaint straight to the tribunal for adjudication without any further investigation if the market inquiry kind of threw up information that enabled us to do that. Then the final issue is around concurrent jurisdiction. This is also something that was very welcomed by everybody. And here, honorable members will recall that there was an Electronic Communications Act that came out, I don't know, in 2006 or thereabouts. And what that act did, prior to that, the Competition Commission and sector-based regulators had concurrent jurisdiction over certain competition matters in that sector. Okay, so we both had jurisdiction over certain things. But the Electronic Communications Act came in and said, at least in the case of telecommunications, that irrespective of whatever the Competition Act says, the Electronic Communications Act stands. It trumps whatever the Competition Act says. So it has overriding, power over it. And essentially that took away the Competition Authority's jurisdiction over some aspects of telecommunications markets. And what the amendment now of the Competition Amendment Act does is it just reverses the situation. We now, whereas previously the ECA had full jurisdiction over the electronic communications sector, this amendment to the Competition Act reconfirms that the Competition Authority has jurisdiction over some of those, over some matters in those markets. And of course, this was something that clarifies the situation in order to prevent the kind of forum shopping that occurs where, private players kind of shop around for the regulator that will give them the best deal. Now just to conclude, some remarks in conclusion, just to kind of reflect on what are the challenges of this Amendment Act for institutions like ours. Obviously, one of the things that's going to happen, in the short, medium term is that regulations need to be drafted to give effect to some of these provisions in the Act, and the DTI is responsible for that. I know that the Department of Economic Development is working closely with the DTI on this matter. I know they're kind of on top of it to some extent. But more importantly, I think, is that it's kind of public knowledge that some sections of the business community are unhappy with the constitutionality of some of these provisions and have clearly signaled that they will oppose it on constitutional grounds should they be affected. I think that's an uncertainty and an unknown for us. You can imagine that it's not very nice for an institution like ours to be getting involved in legal battles. We'd rather spend our time catching the bad guys and dealing with them effectively rather than playing some of these things out in court. So that's an uncertainty for us. But linked to that is that I think that, one of the things a challenge we've got to face is how we kind of coordinate our investigations and prosecutions with the NPA that's an unknown that hasn't happened before. We've already begun talking to them about it. We've already kind of, we're ahead of the curve here. We've kind of, we've even though the bill is not in place, so the act is not in place, we've kind of started those discussions. And kind of working out the synergy between, you know, the civil and the criminal justice processes. That's a new area for us. And also to kind of clarify for ourselves how this corporate leniency is going to work, given the complexity that that this amendment throws at us. I think those largely are the kind of major kind of challenges we face going forward. Of course, it goes without saying that, you know, resource constraints will be also a challenge. You know, if we're going to do many market inquiries, those are resource-intensive things. We have to be resourced adequately to do those things. And some of them, just the other point made in the slide is, for example, in the market inquiry issue and in the kind of investigative issue around criminal standards, we're going to kind of require a different kind of expertise in the commission to kind of deal with those kinds of issues. I should say that we have, as the Commission, engaged in the recent past with the Minister of Economic Development around the implementation of this Act. We've kind of briefed him on what our issues are, and he's kind of he's been made aware of where we're at in the process. I think part of, on his side, you know, he's got, there's still the kind of handover that's occurring between DTI and EED that he's also managing on the other side, which I'm not altogether, you know, I don't know too much about that, but I would imagine that's something he's managing concurrently as well. I've tried to be kind of relatively brief here so that we can spend more time in discussion, so I welcome any kind of questions to clarify issues.
Thank you, Saramburu. I don't know if there are any additions. You see, we'll welcome actually the details. Why? Because we just received this document today, the presentation today, and I guess members who were able to look at the principal act, and some had an opportunity previously to interact on both the principal act and the amendment. So, but I also take it that there are those who are seeing this for the first time and they're interacting with this document for the first time. So if there are any additions or areas that your members feel that they want to stress on, please, you're welcome to do so before I open up for questions.
Thanks, Madam Chair. If you'll excuse my voice, so I've got a bit of laryngitis. So if the law isn't clear, I'm going to make it even less clear today. But I'll do my best. Just to add what Shan has said, I'm from the Competition Tribunal, as is Yasmin Karim. So we look at it from, if you recall what I said last time, we're the court and they are the prosecutor and policeman. So I'm giving you the sort of court's perspective on some of these issues. I think that two of the issues in the amendments, which is, as the Chair has pointed out, has not yet been proclaimed, and which have gained controversy on the complex monopoly and the criminalisation. And let me just give you some thoughts as to why they might be controversial. I think if I can start with the complex monopoly. The complex monopoly is basically to deal with a gap between the cartel conduct, which is illegal, and something which at the moment is not illegal, and therefore it is vague. What can't you do? And so the solution has been to say, well, if there's a problem in the market that's not competitive, we'll bring a case and suggest some remedies, and once we've made these remedies, you may not be able to do that again. So in other words, calling on the Competition Tribunal to make a rule. So let's assume that in an industry, all the firms are pricing in the same way. The prices are very similar. There are only four firms. But there's no proof that they've actually come to an agreement, they've met in a room. But they may have come to the agreement because they publish information on their websites and everybody looks at these things and draws conclusions from that information that this is where the price should be. So the commission could come along to us and saying, we want you to impose the remedy. They may not make that information public. We would then, if we thought it was a good idea, because we don't have to, even if we find it is a complex monopoly, have to give a remedy. But if, let's say, we thought that was a good idea, we would then say you may not publish your information publicly. Only if they thereafter published publicly after just making that order would there be an offence, not before that. The reason people don't like it is they think it's very vague. They say if it's something wrong, it should be under Section 4 when you've got a case. This is a complex monopoly, normally a market reaction in a market where there are few competitors. And, you know, if one firm is pricing in one way, the others will follow that price, otherwise they'll lose business. That's a normal market reaction. Why impute anything illegal in it? So that's the controversy around that, and people find the provisions quite vague and they're very uncertain about what it means. And even though there's some comfort that only the commission as opposed to a private person can bring such a case, they're still apprehensive about that. And some people say it's so vague that it's unconstitutional. The criminalisation thing has got quite a few different challenges. The first is that, as Shan has mentioned already, in the way we've done it, we have a dual proceeding. We have a civil proceeding that goes first in which the firm is an accused, and we decide whether the firm is guilty or not, and we do that on a civil balance of probabilities. If we find the firm guilty, or firms guilty, then the prosecutor can charge individuals, because the prosecutor doesn't charge firms in our system, only individuals. The prosecutor can say, Mr. Jones, you were a member of this firm that was found to have contravened. We're charging you criminally. The prosecutor can only start if we make the finding at the tribunal. And the Act says that there is a presumption if the tribunal has found that your firm has contravened. It has contravened unless the accused can prove the opposite. So in a criminal prosecution, as the law reads at the moment, the only thing the prosecution has to prove is that the individual caused the firm to enter into that, not that the firm was in it. So the criticism has been that this violates the presumption of innocence in our law, which is that you can stay quiet during a trial and make the prosecutor bring the case. So that's the first criticism of it. The second criticism is that we at the tribunal make out the finding that the firm is a member of the cartel on a civil balance of proof, not the more demanding criminal balance of proof. They say that's yet another violation of your accused right to have everything proved on a higher criminal standard. So those are the initial constitutional problems. Other difficulties which may ensue is that you've got what we call a dual system. In America, which is the country with the most successful criminal prosecutions, Department of Justice has one department that does all the antitrust work, and there is only one proceeding. They charge the firm and the individual in the same case, and Department of Justice has a competition division, for want of a better word, in the Department of Justice. They've got economists, they've got lawyers with expertise in that. In all other systems, you have a dual system. In other words, you have the civil authority with the competition expertise, and a normal prosecuting authority which doesn't have that expertise. It is yet to be shown that the new system, because England adopted this in 2002, the Canadians have adopted that recently as well, Ireland and Australia last year in 2009. Australia hasn't prosecuted anybody yet. England is having its first case running at the moment, although it had the law since 2002. Ireland has had a few prosecutions, but it's had some difficulties. But Ireland cannot find firms like we can on a civil level, so they had to go the criminal route. Canada has had some successful prosecutions, but people haven't been sent into jail. They've been given what are called custodial orders, which have been non-jail terms. Now, one of the concerns about the criminal system is that a magistrate, even if they're faced with a case, let's say the case gets to them, may not see the matter as seriously as we do. The same magistrate who's hearing a case that somebody has met with competitors and exchange information is not somebody you should send to jail in the same way as a rapist who appeared an hour before him and has raped some youngster. Is it the same person who should be sent to the same jail? Maps have just shown a reluctance in other jurisdictions to view this as jail sentence time. So if the expectation is that people are going to get a jail, that may not be met because magistrates may not see it in the same way. Secondly, the economic nature of the offence, because the cases don't always turn around, two people met in the room and agreed on the price and signed off on it. Sometimes the inference that there is a cartel is quite complicated. Magistrates may, who have no experience in this area, may struggle in understanding that kind of evidence and appreciating its effect. The next is when, if the law came to being tomorrow, when would the first person, if you ask me, when would the first person go to jail? I would say it'll take a long time still. Firstly, in our law, no crime can be retrospective, it's unconstitutional. So in other words, if I did the same matter today, and the law currently comes into effect tomorrow, you can't prosecute me for what I did today. So in other words, I have to commit the offence only after the law gets proclaimed and comes into effect. Now, with a cartel crime, which has an agreement that is then preceded by conduct, one of the issues is, can you prosecute people only if the agreement occurred after the act came into force? Or would it apply if the agreement happened before the act came into force, but the effects of the agreement, in other words, high prices, were felt afterwards? That would be an area of contestation in the courts or challenge. So it may well be that a prosecutor might say, oh, well, I'm going to wait for a case where the agreement happens after the crime is, you know, after the act was proclaimed, which may take some years to find that. The next delay is that the issue must run in the tribunal before it goes to the criminal court. Up to now, I would estimate that cartel cases, I mean, the Pioneer case, would take about 2 years before the tribunal conclusion, the proceedings are ended. If there's an appeal, there is an appeal going in the Pioneer case at the moment, that can add another 6 months. There could be an appeal from the Competition Appeal Court to the Supreme Court of Appeal and then to the Constitutional Court. So that could add another 3 years to that proceeding before the first criminal case can start. If there's going to be a constitutional challenge in the criminal proceeding, we could be looking for years before this thing becomes effective. So I know this sounds very pessimistic, but I just want to give some of the difficulties that it may face it. Another problem arises from the fact that because our civil proceeding starts first, if search warrants are issued by the Commission or they interrogate witnesses and they do it under civil standards, that evidence might be challenged in the criminal trial as being sought under the lowest standard, therefore inadmissible in the criminal trial. So it may, in fact, make the criminal case again more difficult to run. In most other systems, they make a choice between the civil authority and the criminal prosecutor as to who will take the case. In other words, there's only one proceeding, and they say, all right, is this case strong enough for criminal trial? We'll only have a criminal trial, not a civil proceeding. Under our system, at the moment, we've got both, and the civil one must become before the criminal one, which creates these difficulties and these possible challenges. Shan already mentioned that even if somebody gets leniency from the commission, the prosecutor may still want to prosecute that person. Because the Act simply says that the commission may not ask for that person to be prosecuted, but there's nothing to stop the prosecutor because he doesn't have to ask the commission's permission to prosecute. When might that arise? Well, sometimes the leniency applicant has been the really bad guy in the case, the guy who benefited most from the thing and then went and tattletale to the commission. There might be a feeling with the prosecutor that these are the most guilty people, they should be prosecuted criminally, hence we don't want to recognize that leniency. Now, the problem with the leniency thing is that under criminal law, leniency is not something that even a prosecutor can offer. The prosecutor can say to somebody, we'll let you be state witness, and if you testify truthfully and honestly, we won't prosecute you afterwards. But the judgment as to whether you've done truthfully and honestly is the court who hears that witness, not the prosecutor himself. Under our system, the commissioner's prosecutor is offering leniency. And with that criminal law, that offer of leniency will be respected as criminal law is a matter open for debate and possible challenge. So these are some of the issues that we, the complications that are faced by the Islamic police system.
Yeah, you don't want to be pessimistic, but you actually sound, it sounds like the amendment was just a fruitless kind of an exercise. I mean, if we were to meet the concerns of the people or the objectives of the said amendment. Thank you, Mr. Manuel. But I think now I'll open up for questions from members. You know, as we were speaking, you know, I kept asking myself as to whether there will be a time when we say we will stop this thing, these bad practices within the market. Dr. Rabi,
thank you, ma'am.
Ma'am Lyon, did you have your hand up? Oh, okay. Dr. Rabi?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Shan, I think, again, thank you for your very thought-provoking submission. But I remember, I think it was in 2008, I was still on the Portfolio Committee of the Department of Trade and Industry. A well-known lawyer, Mr. Peter Dion, addressed this, and he said, I don't know whether the constitutionality of complex monopolies has been reworded or the definitions are, but what he says and what basically some of the other speakers have said here this morning, that they say it's extremely vague, and really to apply this, especially in the South African context where a high market concentration has always been here, is very, very, very difficult to prove. In fact, and I think I read an article in Business Day or the Financial Mail that they say that there's definitely going to be, I don't know where, how far you've consulted regarding the complex monopolies with the private sector, but he says there is definitely a possibility that legal action will be taken regarding this. Now, I'd just like to have your views and whether this will, because I think it is important. As you said, administrative law is very important. It refers to the rights of consumers. It's a new phenomenon which is used in most of the developing economies in the world. But I just wanted to know is it possible to furnish us with a deadline when this piece of legislation will be implemented and submitted? Because, as you said, this is a proactive piece of legislation, but we'd like to see whether we can really apply it. And then the second thing is, the criminalization, again, there, that's also extremely complex. And I think whether we're going to apply norms that relate to criminal justice or to civil justice, I think that those two things also need further clarification from legal experts. And I think we as a committee before, we owe this to the public that we have certainty regarding, we cannot rush this piece of legislation through, because I don't think it will have the proper effect which is meant to protect consumers and so forth. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks, Dr. Rabi. Any other comment, question of clarity from members? Okay, while members are still thinking, perhaps you can respond to Dr. Rabi's question, then I will be asking questions.
I'd like to respond first to your comment around fruitless exercise. Okay. I think the one thing
maybe
to say...
Maybe you don't need to.
No,
because
I mean...
Because it was just a general statement.
A general point then is I think that the one thing everybody agrees on across the board, we as the institutions more than anybody else, is that we need to stop this bad behavior, right? And that we need to put into place a law that disincentivizes people from doing this, okay? And so we all at one on that. Then it's how you go about doing it. And we, in the course of the debates that occurred, had alternative suggestions, you know, on how to make it the pain felt a little bit more. So, for example, at the moment, we can only find people on the basis of 1 year's turnover. We made a suggestion that let's find them on the basis of every year that this practice occurred. You know, let's increase the existing criminal fines in the Act. So, you know, the existing criminal fines in the Act is when you kind of lie to the tribunal, and, you know, those are illegal. So, to make it difficult for people to give us false information. So I think that, you know, and I think everybody is very clear in understanding that the moral outrage post the bread cartel was a very appropriate thing. I mean, it's appropriate. People want to say, you know, this is a problem. We need to do something. So, you know, so everybody is at one, is that we need to be tougher as an institution. We need to have, you know, more sanctions, bigger sanctions. It's a lot of these difficulties arise in the way that some of the law is constructed, given our constitution and the rights everybody has under it. And so one has to understand the technical detail to see there might be a snag or not. And we're engaging with all of that right now, and there is a lot of uncertainty, and that is not a great thing, but there's an uncertainty for every new law that's appointed. I don't think we're unique to that. This is not like a unique thing. You know, you're changing the law, things are going to have to readjust and meet in another place. We've got some good provisions in this Act that we welcome, the market inquiries. I think that and just to say that the debates around the controversial issues in and of itself is a good thing. The fact that businesses are talking about this and, you know, kind of thinking hard about these issues around criminalization. Okay, so regarding Peter Leon's comment on complex monopolies, I think we've kind of, Norman has and I have kind of reflected some of the debates that have occurred here and some of those points that we've reflected were indeed made by Peter Leon himself. We haven't consulted with the private sector on this matter. We haven't kind of coordinated anything around this bill with the private sector. It's not our job to do so. As I said, the custodian of this policy process has been the Department of Trade and Industry, and it's for them to do that. So we, the civil servants, you know, they're the policy makers in a sense, and we've kind of, they've been clear and we've been clear that that's our respective role. So we haven't gone outside of the process to speak to people about it. We have on occasion given briefings to people on, like we're doing here, on what the Act is saying, but it wasn't a consultative process by any means. And even your question about when the piece of legislation would be submitted and come into place, that's not for us to be doing. That's for the government department to be doing. And I'm not entirely sure where we're at on that process right now. I mean, we've engaged, there's been a new minister responsible for us, and we've briefed him on everything, and he understands what the issues are. I mean, I'm not sure what else to say about that. I mean, I think that it is unsettling for us, as I said earlier, to kind of be given this. You know, the way I see this whole thing is that, firstly, it's not as though we haven't been effective given what we have currently. I mean, I think that's the one thing that needs, it's not like, you know, here's an agency that's really struggling and suffering to do the work it's doing, let's give it additional powers to make it work. We're not in that situation. We're working with what we have very effectively, I think. You know, so it's not like, and Norman's point is important, even when this kicks in, it's not like it's going to kick in today and in 3 weeks' time we're going to send somebody to jail. It's going to take a long time before all of this plays itself out. You know, we might, you know, In other words, somebody is yet to do the behavior that we will catch them for. So they'll do it in 6 months' time. We'll catch them in another year's time. It'll take us another 2 years to prepare the case. It'll be taken on appeal. You know, we're talking about 5-6 years down the line where you'll see, and that's the nature of the legislative process. You can't help that. It's not like things happen immediately. So I mean, I think thinking in time is important, and it's an important thing, I think, for this agency and for ours and all policymakers is to be very kind of responsible about what expectations we're setting up with this kind of legislation. It's not like it's going to happen overnight. And so the way we see this is that, you know, policymakers have put a few more tools in our toolbox, and we will use those tools appropriately at the right time for the right case when it's needed. You know, you don't choose a tool first and say, what am I going to fix? You have something to fix. You look in your toolbox. You say, which is the best one, and you choose the best one. So you know, I think that in general, that's how we've seen this.
Okay. You want to add on, ma'am? Chairperson, sorry, I haven't been formally introduced to Yasmin Karim, a full-time tribunal member. I just wanted to add something to Shane's response and perhaps in response to some of the pessimism that we might have painted out for you. Now, a lot of our work has, in the last few years, thrown up quite a lot insights into what has been happening in markets in South Africa. Firstly, one sees a trend that a lot of the anti-competitive practices have been old-style business practices which we've inherited. And a lot of the work that the Commission and the agencies that have been doing over the last 10 years has started creating a culture change in business. And one mustn't forget that historical behavior is being challenged in many different ways by the mere prosecution of companies currently. But we're also seeing impact, Chairperson, on shareholders, for example, who are starting to become more active about asking the right questions of companies. For example, the Sasol shareholders became very active in asking the right questions when it became public knowledge that Sasol was engaged in anti-competitive conduct in other jurisdictions. And that led to the company coming clean and settling with the commission and pleading guilty to paying a fine of $250 million. There's also issues of board oversight, and a lot of boards are now becoming educated about competition compliance and asking the right questions of the company. So what I'm saying is that apart from our work as competition agencies, and if you want to look at impact, the impact is we want to deter this kind of behavior, and we do it in different ways. One is that we publicize our prosecutions, we open the kind of conduct up to the public to see, and so others look at it as well. And that's one way of having impact, apart from having the legislative toolkit that Shane was talking about.
Thank you, ma'am. Karima? Yes. Thank you very much. I guess what is important is the fact that fraud is fraud, corruption is corruption. You may call it whatever you want to call it, but we want to root out this behavior in our society. That is the fact. But then the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal has to help us, especially in terms of challenges concerning, you know, inflation in our, you know, in our economy. You know, that is really challenging the poorest of the poor at the end of the day. And why one was talking about pessimism is because of such things. Because, you know, a poor person would not understand that there are certain laws that are preventing, whereas we just amended an act
to make sure that it enables you to do the right word, but then if it's the right thing. But then if you are to say to us, we may not even effect, even if it comes to effect tomorrow, we may not even be able to prosecute one person in the next 5 years, for the next 5 years. That's how long this process takes. And I'm worried about that. Because I'm worried because the law stipulates fines, it stipulates whatever, but it doesn't stipulate the time frame within which the Competition Tribunal and Competition Commission should work within, case by case, of course, looking at case by case. As I said, some of us have not had time to interact seriously with the Act, just to check some of those nitty-gritties. But if there is any stipulation, then it's okay. If there's none, then, you know, I'm worried because you're going to be taking longer, because nothing forces you to work within a particular time frame. And that disadvantages our people. And as I said, the main person here is the poorest of the poor. If the bread price goes up, it's that person who depends on that bread every day in his or her everyday life that suffers. And after the fines, after the prosecution, that person might not get an opportunity to buy that bread cheaper. I mean, these were the issues previously. What are you doing after that collusion, after fining the person, after prosecuting the person? Will the price of the bread go down? No. That's a fact. Agriculture might try by all means to make prices reasonable, but the market still sets the prices. And what are we saying about that? Those are the real issues that we're talking about. And perhaps it's important that we look into the issues of this dual system, civil versus criminal. You're saying it's working in America in terms of reducing, you know, the time spent on a case? If it does, why don't we deal with those issues? We've passed amendments, and I don't know whether we pass them after we have, for instance, studied what happens in other countries. Why didn't we advise likewise, so that we are able then to do what will serve at the end of the day our communities, our people, which is some the areas we're working on. And I'm worried about the firm. You know, you're saying the amendments are now talking about finding an individual as against the firm. Why not both? Because that individual might have done that on an individual basis, but that person is still representing the firm. Because then you are forcing the firm to be vigilant and to be able then to supervise their own people, because I will continue doing this thing, or somebody else might do that. At the end of the day, the firm, you know, clandestinely or, you know, in closed doors, might be able to finance that person, to give that person money, because they know they sent individuals to do that, and they are not going to be fined as a firm. The firm is going to be it's not going to be charged on that. So I think it's important that we look at some of those issues. I don't know whether, because we don't have that opportunity again, because if the law is assented, it is assented. And we will be following this with the minister, of course, especially around the issues of the effective date. Because we want to know when will this act be brought to action. Secondly, the regulations. If I recall well, in terms of the costing of any bill, it was actually the Dora that was talking about the act. Before you come up with a policy, you must have ensured that you've costed you and you're ready with the necessary resources so that after the bill is assented to and the effective date is set, you will just implement without any hiccups. There was a provision in the door. I think we need to look into that again if it's still there. And then I will then question the challenge around resources from your side, because how then did you come up with such a law and encourage it without really looking into the resources? Because that is the first thing that you need to look into so that you don't delay the implementation of any new law. Because we've seen laws previously being delayed because people would give reasons of lack of resources, lack of training, lack of understanding by the public or by the people who are supposed to be implementing that. You still have to go on and train the people, you know, workshop and so forth. And that is why that provision was put in DORA, so that before you do anything, you know that you have set up mechanisms in place to effect the law immediately after proclamation. I think we need to look into that. And I think the issues around the regulations, if this law was passed, as you're indicating here in your presentation, and it was it was assented to on that in August last year, and by now we haven't finalized the regulations. I understand that there were processes of handing over and so forth and so forth. But I guess by now we should be knowing where we stand in. And I'm just worried. We will be following up, of course, with the minister on this issue so that we make sure that we are ready. And perhaps also look into the time frame issue. That will then force you to have necessary people and to resource yourself adequately so that you can meet your obligations. Those are the comments and issues from my side. I don't know if there are any other issues after that. Can I hand over to you, Mr. Ramboros and Mr. Manas?
Chair, there's one issue I just want to clarify in terms of what you said. You know, the time that it takes to use this law has nothing to do with putting a time limit on what the competition, on how long the Competition Commission must take in doing this. It's got nothing to do with this. This only has to do with two things. One is that laws are, what's the opposite of retrospective? Prospective. Laws are prospective, so they're not retrospective. In other words, you put the criminalization conduct that comes into being today. The act that we're going to prosecute for somebody for is still to happen in the future, right? So the criminalization comes in. Somebody's still got to break the law in the future. We've still got to find out that somebody broke the law. We've then got to investigate and find the evidence that says that somebody broke the law, and that in the normal course in the legal system like ours takes time. So it's not like we all got our files waiting the minute the law comes in, we can just produce this evidence because something's already happened. These things are yet to happen in time. And that's the one point to make, right? So it's prospective, it's going forward. Somebody still has to do something illegal, we still have to find them, we still have to make the case. That takes a long time in the normal course on any case. The second thing that will result in delays here is legal challenges, which is what it seems to me business has already signaled they're going to do. So we'll then make our case, we'll take it to the court. Then there will be legal challenges. It's not constitutional. We'll put out the case on the side and we'll spend a long time dealing with clarifying the law. those are the two things that are going to lead to delays. It's not, I just want to say, it's not about putting a time limit on the commission. What are we going to do? We're going to say, look, from the time this law comes into being, the commission must find somebody in the next 6 weeks. It doesn't work like that.
Maybe you need to answer this question then. How long does it take you currently to deal with this case?
It can take, well, with legal challenges, it can take anything from a year to 5 years.
Exactly.
So in the normal course, right? This is in any case.
No. I'm referring to issues without going, outside your scope of or area of
right.
work.
Okay.
Yes. Within yourself, how long do you take?
Yes,
to process a case?
Contested case takes that long. We've been working much faster recently because of our corporate leniency policy, which speeds everything up. And the fact that through that we reach consent agreements with parties. That's what you're seeing as faster things coming out of the commission has to do with that. I'm talking about a contested case, where you take a case against somebody and they contest it. They don't cooperate with you.
Yeah, I want the time frame.
How long do you take?
You can indicate there's a complex. If it's a complex case, this is how long we take. If it's an easy case, this is how long we take. Just to give us
one to five years, I think is a reasonable time.
Just to give you a sense, one of the quickest cases we've investigated. Within a 3 month period, and we got finality on those matters within 6 months, and those were bread cases where there were CLPs and settlements. That's one extreme. The other extreme has been cases like ANSEC, which holds the record for taking the longest, which was about 9 years. So the period varies, but I would say the average would be an investigation period of about 18 months, and including the tribunal period, cases take about 2 years. That's really what I perceive to be the average, but they vary. I do want to make one point about time, though, in the context of amendments, if I may. I think the issue here is about the scheme we have chosen, because the scheme we have chosen says that a criminal prosecution can only commence once the tribunal and court process has been finalized. So, and I accept the challenge that you do want to shorten competition proceedings in general, and that's a debate we must not run away from. But even as you do that, when the criminal process kicks in, then you have no control at all, because accused persons have rights and they must go through the court system. So I think that's the biggest problem. A criminal trial can take for as long as the accused is prepared to challenge the case.
Okay, I think we understand that the system's problem. We do, but I wanted us, we're not underestimating the type of work you're doing. Obviously, as we said previously, that we are very happy with most of the work that you're doing. But I think the public out there is not patient, because, there are a lot of expectations. As soon as you say we have competition commission, because many people didn't know for competition commission, but then you had to, through the cartels that you've exposed and so on and so on. People now have a lot of expectations. And with those expectations, you have to respond. It means more responsibility on your side. And more responsibility means that you have also to look at your shortcomings. And those, how then do you deal with issues of your shortcomings within the your system itself? That's what we're trying to say. You might short-circuit some of the things, it's true, and then through that collaboration you were talking about with NPA, when are those talks beginning so that you are able then to say, you know, we can deal with this matter, perhaps even simultaneously? While you are doing this work, they're starting also with another work. They might set up something within the NPA to deal with that. You don't know, but I think those talks must begin so that we appreciate the new initiatives that you're coming up, or the objectives of the new of the amendments that the president has assented to. So those are the issues that we are mostly concerned about. Manon, you wanted to say something?
I want people to be thinking that the existing system is not working. Mm. It's working, and it's working very well. And firms are getting fined, and firms, as Ms. Karim said, are changing their behavior. And the first thing, the most important thing, is public exposure. So in other words, to change a firm's behavior, in fact, it's been publicly exposed through a leniency applicant coming forward to the commission, and the commission saying, we're bringing this case, which they do, is the most important issue in changing a firm's behavior. Having a criminal trial, eventually sending somebody to jail, is not necessarily going to be the thing that brings the price down. What will be the most effective is actually exposing that there is a cartel in this industry, and exposing those firms to very large fines. Because the fines at the moment, even with the law unchanged, are 10% of the firm's turnover. And so the fine on Pioneer Foods, 197.6 million rand, is a very big fine, even for a large firm to be paying. And it's the sort of fine that gets shareholders angry and moving and saying, I didn't get my dividends this year. What are you going to do about it? Why are you going to change? How are you going to change this thing from happening? And the commission is, when it can, moving very quickly. Last 2 weeks ago, we, in a milling case, they settled with the firm even before they referred the thing, because the firm... The commission can bring a consent order, which is a plea bargain to us, at any time after they've started the investigation. And so long before they've even referred, in other words, charged the cartel, the firm has already pleaded guilty, and we've given the order confirming the plea bargain.
Thank you. Any other questions, members? No, no more questions. We had, Mr. Ramboro, we had budgeted for... to work until 12:30. I don't know if we can utilize this time because we still have time. If we don't, if we feel that there are no questions and no interaction with this, because this is a very important piece of legislation that we must know as members, and so that we can be able to assist our people out there in our constituencies. Mr. Ramboro, you wanted to say something, but before you, can I ask Ms. Sojit to say something? I don't know whether you want to comment or...
No, it's just a clarification that as soon as the commission finds out that a price has been fixed and embark on an investigation, let's say you continue the case, is it possible for you maybe to effect something to say, let the price go to the standard price, or the consumers will continue to pay that price until you are done with the case? I'm not clear. I'm not sure if I'm putting my question or my concern clearly. It's just a confusion in my mind in terms of the price, that as you continue the case, do you still continue to pay the price until you are done with the case?
Mr. Ramboro,
thanks. Just if I can address that question first, and others will help me. The first point to make is that the commission never sets a price. The competition authorities never, ever tell firms what price they must set. We never do that. What we do is we deal with the anti-competitive behavior that resulted in that results in higher prices, and we want to get rid of that behavior. So without that anti-competitive behavior, without collusion or abusive behavior, we then leave it for society, namely the markets or whatever you want to say, to sort this out in the relationships that all the different players will have them with each other in the marketplace. So we never set a price.
I don't necessarily going to set the price. That's why I say I'm not even sure if I'm phrasing my speaking question correctly. That you have by any means maybe make a recommendation. I'm not going to set the price, but just making sure that as you continue with the investigation, you know, on the other hand, consumers do not continue to suffer in terms of the price.
If I can just answer that quickly, this question has been raised before. The powers currently, in terms of the legislation, is only that the authorities can order the conduct to stop and they can impose a fine. Those are general remedies that we have with the statutes. There are people who have suggested that perhaps in settlements you can incorporate certain things. That would be outside the framework of the current legislation. I raise this because people have said what do consumers benefit, what happens to prices after you have intervened. Currently, in terms of the legislation, we don't have that power.
Yeah, we know in cases, in terms of the cell phone issue, the minister then issued that. But then who is responsible for repricing? Because you noticed that there was this practice, and then you intervened. What is your role in terms of recommending to the relevant authority in terms? But by the time you intervene, you know that the price was at this level. But due to this collaboration, the prices have upped by perhaps 75 or 100% or even 200%. What do you do as the Competition Commission to assist in this process? That's only, I think, what the question wants to get from you. Come in before that.
Okay. Who is responsible? You are, actually. Parliament is. Politicians are responsible. I mean, in order to set a price, in order to set prices, what you're doing is you're regulating markets, right? And that is a political decision. That is a political call to be made that, you know, we want to set the price of bread at this level or another level. And there's processes around how one goes about a policy process to do that and to kind of set up institutions to monitor it. And there are instances like the telecommunications, for example, where prices get set at a particular level. But that's not our call to make. Our call is about just creating the conditions in a market for there to be fairness and for people to sort things out, for the market to work, in other words. You know, we just level the playing field, ensure everybody has proper access, there's fairness, and that's where our role stops. Okay? That's just
yeah, I can see you running away from the question, Mr. Ramboro. We understand that.
Right.
We understand your core business. We do understand, but we say, as people who are detecting these anomalies, what is it that you can do to assist so that, you know, this competition is brought back to normality? That's what, that's the basis of the question. Because sometimes a minister, because if you say it's politicians, I'm not...
Well, I'm saying it's a political call. That's a political
yes,
decision.
Yes, but your role also is to advise, isn't it? So I'm saying, perhaps even if it's not legislated anywhere, you could perhaps give yourself that task to advance, because you are dealing with these things. You understand what competition means. And a particular minister might not understand things the way you understand them. And therefore, I think perhaps you could assist in, if people are not aware, in making them aware that this is your responsibility. Under these circumstances, you could do 1, 2, 3. So that, because the people who are going to benefit are those people who've been asking you whether will you be able then to, as to what is the benefit of us as communities in terms of what you are doing. The work you are doing is good. You are finding people, but after finding, they go back to the same practices, or they go back and they're still receiving, you know, money above what they're supposed to be achieving. That's the fact. Because they might have paid that, but they will be able to get that money anyway. And they might go back and say, we up the price because you find us, and then for us to recover that money, we have to up the price. Who's going to help in that regard?
Okay. Can I just directly respond to this quickly? I see your question, and I know what you're saying. And I can only offer you an answer I gave the last time I was here, which you weren't entirely happy with as well. But and that is, you know, you made the point earlier as well that, you know, we need a multi-pronged approach, and even with whatever it is you're doing, the market still sets the price at whatever it wants to set it at, right? But I think when we say something like the market sets the price, like who is the market? You know, there are people, there are individuals there that are taking decisions. It's not something that is just happening, you know. And I think that one of the big points that we have to make all the time, and is evident in our work, is getting all the other players in markets and in society generally to kind of rally around this issue and kind of play their part in it. And I think we've been very successful at that. I mean, Yasmin's already spoken about the fact that, you know, in the recent past, you're seeing the impact of our work in boardrooms. You know, the Pioneer Board was changed as a consequence of our work. That, you know, our work is definitely being discussed in boardrooms. You know, so at that level in corporate structures, I think that we need to kind of influence people there and how they think and how they take decisions. And we've got lots of programs doing that, and I think we've been fairly successful there. But also all the other players, you know, like the NPA and our coordination with them, consumers and consumer organizations, you know, civil society organizations. I think that is when everybody else, when we must create, we must provide information and create conditions for other sections of society to begin to assert themselves in the marketplace. And I think that's all we can do. We're not like the heavy-handed kind of institution that takes these decisions on behalf of other people. We kind of open things up for different sections of society to kind of respond appropriately and for them to hold each other accountable.
Thanks,
Manuel. What we do is we break the collusion. The reason the price was high, that there was a colluded price. If the people didn't collude, the price would be lower. So they met and agreed on a higher price above the level it would be in order to get a better return. By intervening as we do, we stop these people agreeing. You know, we create a huge disincentive to agree. If you agree the price, you're going to expose publicly and you will pay a huge fine. So by stopping that agreement, the firms now are in a competitive relationship with one another. So what will the firm do now they're in a competitive relationship? They'll say, I couldn't get the cartel price any longer, so I'm now going to lower my price and grab market share from the guy I was colluding with and compete back that game. And that's what we're trying to do. No competition authority that I know of, as a remedy to collusion, sets the price. Because you'd get the price wrong. It would either be too high, or you have lacked sufficient information to know what they could really charge in a competitive market, or too low. If it's too low, you'll drive firms out of the market, and in others will be completely counterproductive. So what you're trying to do is to break the behavior that lets the high price. In other words, you disincentivize them from colluding and meeting. And the very first act of actually exposing that there was agreement already starts the process of actually breaking it down. Because now they've been found out. They've been caught secretly meeting. We know what you're up to. We're watching you.
Please, and I can make one point related to this. There is a remedy in the legislation currently in the Act that allows parties who have been complainants or who have suffered damages from anti-competitive practices to sue. And I'll give you an example. We had you might recall this. This was a bidding cartel in the health sector, and these companies had colluded in bidding for Department of Health, bidding for a tender for the Department of Health in relation to drips. And in fact, it was pediatric drips. And we had, in the course of the investigation, the commission had approached the department at the hearing where the companies came and they pleaded guilty and said we had colluded. And we find them, one of them was in fact Adcock Ingram, and in fact, at that time, there was a change in the CEO of Tiger Brands. The department was present in the hearing, and we then made them aware that given these acknowledgements of liability and guilt, and we had fined those companies quite substantial amounts, the department now had a right to proceed with a civil claim against them. Nothing came out of that. So there are other parties who must also start exercising their rights in terms of this legislation. And maybe one of our shortcomings is that we are not talking enough to the public about these what exists at the moment in the legislation and what remedies are available. Take, for example, the SAA case. When we had found that SAA had abused its dominance in the market, at that time Nationwide, which is still a functioning company, did sue SAA for civil damages. They settled it out of court, but it did pursue its rights. And this morning at breakfast, I was speaking to somebody from Water Affairs, and we were chatting about the same issues we're raising here. How do consumers get the benefit of this in a direct way? Well, firstly, we need to look at how to educate consumers around starting to form, go to consumer councils and say, look, from now onwards, let's try and build up an evidence about a particular market. If we think that there is overpricing in chicken, we know that the commission is investigating the chicken industry. Let's make sure that we send 10 consumers, they go buy chicken every day from these different shops, and you collect, gather evidence so that by the time the commission comes, finds the cartel and we find them, these consumers are ready to take civil action against those companies. And we must also engage with our trade unions. Our trade unions are in every sector of the economy. You know, with ICASA, they only deal with telecommunications products. We deal with every sector, and perhaps we should be engaging more with them, saying, how are you ensuring that your members who are consumers, of course, they're not necessarily the poorest of the poor, but certainly that's where we can start and say, let's create sections within your organization that can start engaging with us on these issues and how you can find a way to pursue your rights that currently exist in the Act, and that's possible. So that's one way we can focus our energies on, maybe.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just wanted to add one more thing by way of an example on what we've been doing on bread. Because I think it's going to illustrate the point that much as we may not be able to have all the answers to this problem, we do recognize it. We do acknowledge that it is a problem. What do you do with bread prices? We found a cartel in bread, and one of the interesting features of the bread cartel is you have high concentration, very high concentration of bakeries, which is a bit surprising when you consider how simple it should be to enter the market, because you are simply baking bread. It doesn't require specialist skills, not a whole lot of resources. A lot of people can bake bread. Now, the interesting thing about this cartel is you find that the people who were involved with it were also the people who were the millers. So they were selling flour. So to be able to make bread, you needed the flour. That could be one possible explanation why you don't see a lot of bakeries coming in. Now, it is true that you are not going to be a whole lot effective if you simply find a cartel, a bread cartel, because you haven't dealt with the problem of high prices, which arises from collusion of vertically integrated firms who are also producers of flour. Now, once we've had a look at, and we've pretty much finalized the cartel cases on bread, in other words, the price-fixing cases on bread, we went back, because we were also very concerned about the same issue you're concerned about. What happens, what do consumers get? Do prices fall? Which is a question we always ask. We went to look at it, and prices were not falling. So we had intervened, we busted the cartel, but the prices were not falling. We get all sorts of explanations, the wheat prices are up and so on. But when we look at wheat prices, even when they go down, bread prices are not falling. And this has prompted us to initiate a new investigation because we've realized that perhaps bread companies don't need to sit down and agree on prices in order to maintain high prices. They can monitor what each is doing because they are fewer. And we found that, in fact, through industry association, they had the mechanism to do that. So they were exchanging prices. They knew who had market shares and what would happen in certain regions. So they had detailed information about each other's conduct. So we've got a new case that's looking at those dynamics beyond just an agreement. And I can say that we also recognize that even after that case, unless you are able to have smaller people who are able to compete with major bread bakeries, you are not going to have pro-competitive outcomes. Recently, in fact, yesterday, we were talking to the EDD minister about how to make a difference in this sector. And we did say that we will do our bit, but it does seem to us that you need a multi-pronged strategy. What are we doing through our financial institutions to make sure that there is entry? So you need to talk to people like the IDC and see whether there's any assistance that could be made to small bakers. From our part, there are clear exclusionary conduct, again, that we can deal with where people are supplying flour at a high price or are predating. Those are things we can deal with. But someone has got to hold a hand of smaller suppliers in order to be able to break the concentration. So that's one way in which we these things can be done. But they are difficult. They do require a multi-departmental effort. This is what we said to the Department of Agriculture Portfolio Committee as well when they called us to talk about high food prices, is that we can make interventions, but I think there needs to be a lot more thinking about what could effectively change the structure of the market to lower prices.
Thank you very much. Why we're raising these things the way we're raising them is because government has initiated a cluster process, meaning that you work according to clusters, so that we avoid this is the work I'm doing, and therefore if somebody else outside, you know, the work I'm doing is not responding, it's none of my business. We want to do away with that. And if you really want to do, you must avoid that silo, because you will act on something, but it won't make an ultimate impact unless you collaborate with others. So this is what we are encouraging. Make sure that all stakeholders involved, you involve them. That affected, I mean, you involve them. So that at the end of the day, we are able to deal with this problem that you are tasked to deal with. This is our plea, because otherwise we won't know. And unless somebody says to us, wake up, we've done 1, 2, 3, we won't know. Every knowledge is power. That's why you can only act if you know. You have knowledge about something. So it's important that perhaps, like Mem Karim has said, you need to up your information, you know, dissemination process. Make sure that people are more informed of everything that you are doing. As to how you do that, I think it was Competition Commission where you said you're going to change things, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of the public education issue. Yes. So if you can do so and come up with a mechanism as to how best you do that, because these are issues that ordinary people are not educated about. Unless you say something, they'll follow that. They will follow that which they don't know. Say it and educate them, educate them, educate them. And they will know that this is our responsibility, and they'll begin to take action. Same applies to members of parliament. If we don't know, we won't be able to assist. So it is important that we keep each other abreast in terms of some of these issues. We follow the media, of course, but as members, as politicians, we don't have to respond to media. There must be a way of informing us so that we are able then to assist in the process. I think this. You want another question, ma'am?
Not a question, Chairperson, but I just want to comment, Member Karim here, that her response really clarified, not 100%, but at least it brings some light to us. And I think with such a comment or response, and Ramburu will consider adding more women in his team.
Thank you. This is women make things practical, actually. They understand what it means at the end of the day. Whatever you could be doing, but at the end of the day, they are practical people. They understand what it really means, because that's their terrain. Can we then assume that this is the end of our interaction for today? Let's thank you very much. Continue doing the good work, and you.